Hello.
Kia ora. Hello. Good morning.
How are you, Juliana?
I'm well. How are you today? You must be sailing.
Yes, nice to meet you finally, virtually.
Awesome.
I guess what time? Early morning, 9 a.m. in New Zealand.
Well, it's 9 a.m., but that's not early here.
Oh.
Not for me.
Oh, really? Early riser?
Not for me. I have been. It's duck hunting season in my part of the world, and those hunters, they were out at the crack of dawn.
Oh,
Yeah.
really? That's an
Yeah.
abrupt way to start the day.
It is. It's slightly alarming. It's really the only gunfire we hear in New Zealand on a regular basis, but it's still alarming.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for doing this. Really appreciate it. Yeah, it's great to meet you and have a conversation. I've really enjoyed learning about your work. And as I mentioned, these profiles are quite open. I was thinking because your work is so interdisciplinary and multimodal, maybe I would frame it as kind of use audio as well as text and maybe try and include snippets of the conversation we have with a written interview question or maybe experiment a little bit.
Sure. I'm perfectly okay if you want to post-production edit, curate, whatever goes up. If that means cutting and pasting to suit.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the flexibility and I'll send you what I have and then kind of get your okay. But
Sure.
mostly I was had a few questions that I was hoping to talk to you about. I know your work broadly sits at the intersection of philosophy and architecture and design and performance. And I guess just to begin, I was interested to know your trajectory and how you arrived at this interdisciplinary space and practice.
Okay, gosh. Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you for recognizing the inter-transdisciplinarity aspect of my practice, which, yeah, it's one of those things that so much of the world is into this taxonomy, this classification, this pigeonholing. And I grew up with that. I started my journey officially, I guess, through education. I studied first landscape architecture, geology, and switched to architecture. And I switched to architecture midway, having to catch up on a lot of structural engineering courses and mechanical systems courses during the summer. I switched because I was not getting the intellectual stimulation that I needed from landscape architecture, which at that time was, at the risk of offending all the landscape architects in the world, lots of markers, lots of color coding, not really looking at ecological systems in general, and not really keyed into a kind of theoretical base. So that I shifted to architecture. And during that time, I think that was the first time. Yeah, I had three houses that I renovated, and this really started my construction phase of tearing things apart, putting them back together again, and really developing a kind of signature, or better, an approach to building that had to do with what's existing, how to make it better for the building's sake, as well as in terms of maintenance, but also for the inhabitants. And in response to climate, and I'm not being too fussed about the kind of aesthetic style that it was. So this has lingered. I think I've done renovated maybe 15, 16 houses, some mostly by myself, sometimes with my husband, and sometimes with the aid of other construction workers. Yeah, and so I grew up in a household. My mother is a painter and a English teacher, and those two things have influenced me a great deal, especially the English teacher side. I think that's really what introduced me to poetry, fiction, and writing has always been well, first started as a sideline, a hobby, and now it's a serious endeavor for me. Am I going too slow?
No, this is
Okay.
great. I yes, please.
Okay. So I finished my architectural education, which is a 5-year degree from Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia, and shifted to Charleston, South Carolina. From Charleston, South Carolina, in Charleston, I worked as an intern architect, mostly for Amanda Griffith, where I did historic preservation work in the old Charleston sector, as well as some pro bono work for the city of Charleston in the section, which is just north of the Spoleto Festival line, helping Black American communities fix their houses or renovate their homes to make them either more warm, give them another bathroom. And it was really a kind of a functional thing. So again, my kind of construction sensibility set in, and that's where I started to lose any kind of sense of any ambition for working for famous architects or doing things on the stardom level. But that was greatly fulfilling to me. From there, I went back to Virginia Tech and I started teaching. And I think I probably could credit this to my first academic job and sense of what academia could do, more than just being a stable job, but being a place dedicated to research and to practice, creative practice research as well, before it was even a fashionable term. I worked numerous places. You can see my CV, but my intern architecture career went for about another 8 years, and I went to Boston. And then during that time in Boston, I worked as a construction laborer as well as an intern architect, and decided that I really wanted to go back to university, and I wanted to really focus on the art side of architecture. And this is one of those places where architecture has become so, in the last 20 years, maybe more, has become so much more focused on the project management, the health and safety, the regulations, the technology. And though I was always interested in construction, I was not interested in the kind of administration or the bureaucratic side of it. Yeah, and I also saw architecture as an art form that engaged purpose. And you might hear that this is where design is starting to design it in its classical sense of mass produce, serving people, making life better, et cetera, et cetera. Art form could be forecasting, it could be critiquing in its drawn form, and the issues, and its built form, and the issues that it brings up contribute to a larger discourse. And that has eventuated into a spatio-political, cultural, geographical, social kind of practice, I guess. Let's see if I can hit on a few other things. I went from Boston to Cranbrook Academy of Art, where I got my master's, and a class of students led by the artist in residence Dan Hoffman, who preceded Daniel Libeskind. And Dan's approach was very much a construction approach. I thought I was coming in to draw architecture, and no, I was coming in to build with a sensibility to the material, to the culture of architecture, and philosophy. And this is really where philosophy became quite significant to me. Perhaps not the kind of philosophy I'm reading now. Mind you, at that point in my education and at that studio, gosh, I might offend the other people now. It was very much a bloke's world. We were reading phenomenology, but on the side, you know, Blanchot and all kinds of really heavy hitter masculine type writers. So so at Cranbrook, I had many side jobs that extended from anything from repairing people's houses to gardening, to cleaning people's houses, you know, and being a museum guard inside the museum. And so all of those things started to kind of add to my repertoire of concerns, especially for daily life and living and how one lives. Yeah, so I'm going to keep answering this question more precisely. I graduated from Cranbrook, and there was a recession as well as an Iraq war, and there were no jobs. There were no jobs. I think I sent out 50 applications, and I got nothing back. And this was just in the Detroit, Michigan area. So I went back onto my skills and got a job as a gardener at a greenhouse, and then eventually started my own landscaping business, which went all over the Michigan, Detroit, Pontiac Lakes district. And that was blissful. And one of the things that I learned through that was, it was just word of mouth. I learned that there was a real need for people to learn how to do some really basic repair skills, not so much in their gardens, but in their houses. And these people were all widows, divorcees. They were a certain demographic of people. And so I set up a business adjacent with my landscaping business to do these jobs. And then that eventuated into how to teach people to do them themselves, to enable them. And again, that was really an amazing thing to be able to do. Okay, so what's entered into this field significantly is a concern for architecture as an art form, philosophy, gardening, landscape was always there, construction, building materials, and many of these things, doing them with one's own body. Okay, so I won't go through the whole CV, but eventually what occurred was that I moved to New Zealand. I got a job teaching construction and theory in the architecture school there, and that showed me how these things that are usually pulled apart, theoretical concerns for architecture and art and construction technology, the science of architecture, how they had a compatibility, how they worked together. And when I added landscape in, that kind of opened it up to a kind of ecology of practices. And I think Elaine Frichot writes about my work in those terms. What else do I have in there? Well, I shouldn't forget the feminist part at all. I mean, that's for me, that's kind of like drinking air and breathing water. It's just there all the time. And it's changed a great deal over the last 40 years through all various ways of things. And I do admit that I play with wearing certain tags, such as, you know, I wouldn't call myself a first wave feminist, but I do currently play with the notion of being an eco-feminist. And I've even considered dropping it completely, noticing how it sometimes loses an audience, loses a listener, when the cause is so important for all people, using the bell hooks notion of feminism is for everyone. Now I'm going to stop there because... I struggle with this interdisciplinarity stuff a lot. University yeah. systems are, unless they have a special department, which is weird in itself to have a special department of interdisciplinarity or transdisciplinarity. That's just weird because it's like othering to a high degree. Mm. But I do struggle with it because it's not the same as a jack of all trades. So that phrase is very demeaning and not very kind to say. It's not a generalist. It's really practicing, I believe, what many, especially Deleuze and Guattari, speak about as kind of a rhizomatic, or even a actor network theory, a parliament of things, a sense of lateral thinking and doing that is not about the expert. Yeah.
I mean, I so appreciate you sharing your trajectory, because as you say, I work in an interdisciplinary field, and it is very hard to describe. I find even in sound studies, it's a very hard field to describe. But I was really struck when you were talking about how I do kind of critical theory, and there's so much talk about kind of theory versus praxis. I found when I was reading your chapter on performing care, you know, there's all these kind of concepts of intimacy and care, but they often remain very theoretical. So it was really interesting to hear you talk about just, the materiality of building a house, as you know, and also spatial theory is seems like a really important relationship to have in knowledge and in the university.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of work to be done. I haven't written about this, but perhaps in my coming golden years I will. That the really theory is a construction. It is not fact. We know that to be a case. It's not fact. It's a kind of hypothetical thing. So if we consider words as material, as I do, and if we consider material as a mode of communication, the act of building or making a mode of communication, that we can theorize through our creative acts. We are theorizing through our creative acts, and it's just, I think, building up the skills around recognizing what the, maybe not the equivalence of syntax, but what the vocabulary is. See, I'm struggling with finding the words because the words are the language is dominant, where I'm really interested in what does a gesture offer to construct a theoretical, to postulate about what if.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, well, when I was reading about, am I saying this right?
Trist. Oh, to have a tryst.
Okay. I was going to ask you about the title. That makes sense. I have lots of questions about it. I was really struck by the fact that you didn't include visuals and, yeah, just kind of the sterile setting of a hospital, but then this intimacy. And I was thinking about that, how there's so many dynamics that come with creative performance that really can't be described, because I was really kind of struggling to describe it to myself. But I'd be really interested to hear a bit about that project, maybe some of the theories that were at work for you in making it.
Okay. Yeah. It's important to credit Trist as a collaborative work that I did with Andy Locke, and to recognize the Haviland Hospital in Bergen, who gave us the room and permission to use the ventilators. So all of that's really important. So this was the first time Andy and I had collaborated. I went to Bergen from New Zealand for various reasons. I go over there every year or have. And we're both interested in various ways that interlude the gap. And this is very much Andy's research, so I have to credit him. And I'm going to say it terribly, so I probably would need to add a link to some of Andy's work, where he's really very, very articulate. So we worked for a couple of months ahead of time, just talking back and forth, sharing stories, fictions, anecdotes, thinking about words like interlude, gap, the between. And he comes from it as an absence. An absence of presence. And there's tons of literature and artworks around that topic. And I was coming from it in the direction of hiatus, or a suspension, a pause that is idle and poised. And I think that's where I recall we went towards this breath thing. He latched onto the ventilator machine, and I saw this amazing possibility to explore breath. And I got into this thing where I was pulling apart sound files, recording people breathing, or where is that moment of between an in-breath and an inhale and an exhale. Mm-hmm. And I was very much taken back to my childhood. I remember ironing clothes in front of the television when the U.S. Senate was debating the moment when a fetus became a baby, or when life, you know, when they were debating the abortion laws then, believe it or not, here we go again, right? And I was fascinated, and so ironing became not the drudgery, it became just a way to kind of live through all of this rhetoric, all of these people talking. And I happen to have a memory that says that it was inconclusive. It couldn't, I mean, you can pronounce it, like you can say, this is one and this is two, but you can't, this is this thing about temporality and ecologies and living, that if one says something is alive here and not alive here, then there has to be a threshold. But the threshold is assumed to be cut and dry, to be a point, or to be a space where there is nothing. And so if one reads other parts of my creative works, you will know I'm an advocate for the vitality of all matter, not just organic matter, but all matter. So it's always living. It's always alive. It's always animate. It may be still, it may be in different states of transformation. It's not even it. It's not even a nameable thing. It's a coagulation, and that's where it becomes named. So this this hiatus was the place where, kind of like a sine curve in mathematics, where it changes from a amplitude and then it might come down, or it might change its direction, like a sound wave would go up and down. These points of change, and I can't remember what the actual geometric term is. I should look that up. These are the moments where the breath takes a change of direction, a dramatic change of direction. And I was looking for that. And so I was cutting up files. I was looking for where do I take that razor blade and in Premiere Pro, and where do I put that, or what space is it at? And that was a really amazing experiment, because it revealed to me that one couldn't. It couldn't be located. There's not a, when you're speaking a sentence and you take a breath, you're actually seeming to take in air while you're pushing out air, Farrah Sanders in a circular breathing. You're doing this, and the sound is because of that. And so again, there's this kind of rhythmic, cyclical, ongoing thing that happens. So that was my contribution to Trist. And when we heard, we went in thinking that we would identify this gap phenomena with these machines. And Trist is not the only work that came out of that 4 days. It was the one, I think, that we both think that we're completely collaborating. We are machines as much as machines are breathing the room. Everything was kicking in. Yeah, did I answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, thank you. I loved what you said about, you kind of described it as a duet, I think, and sign-up mm-hmm. rhythm. And it was just making me think about our idea of musical sound versus sounds that we would not attribute musical qualities. And because listening to it, you really do hear a duet, but there's something about the setting that is so not outwardly musical. And also what you're saying about the in-between, just the ventilator being kind of so on the precipice of a vulnerable state. It was really interesting.
Yeah. The visuals, we didn't take any visuals other than that one photograph. Mm. And the behind the visuals, behind the audio, you know, we're turning knobs. We're reaching over that stainless steel cart mm. to the other person's machine. We are doing this kind of entanglement. I think the narrative of the sound file, final one, I think the narrative takes a relatively simplistic or direct expected route, where, you know, there's this amplitude and then drop off and cut. I guess that for me now, several years later, that's probably the part that I least like about it. I like that those moments where one gets lost in it, and there's no sense of beginning or end. But that's the nature of a duet or a tryst. There's usually a kind of change to something else.
Yeah, I noticed that when I was looking through your work that you do a lot of sound work, and there was another because you have breathing as well.
Yeah,
I know you're obviously you work in many mediums, but I was interested to hear you talk. I mean, what draws you to sound as a medium of expression?
Right. Well, this kind of goes back to your first question, in that over the years I got very disillusioned with architecture in its practical, professional form. And then I went to teaching, and I was asked to teach a course that was construction for architects, building scientists, and interior designers. Now, you'd think that they would all have similar thoughts or practices, but no, they're not. They have, in general, they have different ways of thinking. They have different ways of appropriating, learning, and their priorities are different. So that course led me to interior design, and to also see how it had not been thoroughly theorized or contextualized in history relative to significant texts or significant issues. So, so I went in and I started to teach in interior design. I wrote a book with Mark Taylor on it. And that's kind of like a satellite to my practice and my teaching. And even in interior design, I became really dissatisfied with the notion and the practice of representation, the way you would draw things, and they wouldn't really be there. They would be pictures. They would be slightly, for me, hollow things. Now, other people think that they're otherwise. I find them hollow. I find them unsatisfying from a embodied experience. So there was this, I can't remember the moment, but there was a point in time where I just said, I can't deal with this any longer. I'm going to work full scale with my body. And you can see the construction and the gardening and everything coming together. And that's what motivated me to do my PhD, where I shifted from this, let's draw it, let's imagine it, and let somebody else build it, to I'm going to do all of this myself. I'm going to look at what that interface and encounter is. And the one of the things that I found when that happened was that space was not about the visual. It became not frugal, what's the word? It became less than, it became unsatisfying. When I opened up my body to spatial experience, the acoustic, the aural, rose to the top. Now, so I'm really nervous, especially in the context of the community that will probably see this work that we're talking about today, is that I'm really nervous about calling myself a sound artist. And this is so contradictory to everything I've said already today, is that I'm not trained in sound. I'm probably the least musical person, unless you can get a degree in hearing acutely. I think I listen pretty well. So the breathing work and the entering into sound was not just for sound and certainly not musical. It was the phenomena that registers body and bodies, all kinds of bodies, human, non-human entities, physical things, spiritual things, and they become, I'll use a Latourian phrase, or many people use it now, assemblage. They become this kind of thing that's bounded. Boundaries are usually permeable, but everything's in play. So I know I'm in the world because I am getting signals from other things around me that are hearing me, or I'm hearing them. There's something going on. There's a presencing going on. Yes. So that's the reason why there's usually no visuals connected. And when there are visuals, I really think about it quite a lot, because I think that they deter us away from what I think. I credit Salome Vivlin, her, and I'm paraphrasing here, that sound has this power to pierce through the visual and be there. It's the now. It's always the now, and it's always present, and it's not even an it. You are it with it. I don't have the words. I should go look up her quote. She's right over there on my shelf.
I do find, hearing you speak about sound versus sighted, I've lately been thinking about how, being in quarantine, I've come to notice so many sounds that I never noticed before, and not musical sounds, but sounds that, as you say, are very presencing, just even if it's the presence of a dripping tap or, you know, yes, a wasp in the room. And it's a very interesting field because it's so elusive, but it's so, so present. Yeah. What's your kind of research right now, or are you working on a project at the moment?
Oh, I've always got them going.
I was thinking you have a lot of projects.
Yeah.
You're so busy.
Yeah, I've tried to slow down because I found over the last couple of years that I've put a lot out, and that was because I have a ethic of iteration, practice, and I'm not afraid to put out things that are perhaps what some say might not be polished enough, but for me it's about making public my practice. So I put stuff out whether it's completely ready or not. But the projects I have going are all they've all shifted. They've had to shift. I had four works that I was supposed to be doing later on this year overseas, and all of them have fallen over, of course, and I'm finding new ways to deal with them, to imagine them. So one of them has come back to New Zealand to be in the Wellington or the Whanganui Atara Harbour, and that I can speak about that one. I'm collaborating with Fraser Walker, a composer, sound artist, installation artist, and he and I are working on a performance video where I am behaving in the performance as a contemporary cuckoo clock to warm at WARM and WARN a farewell greet things coming in and out of the harbor. And there was a 40 odd years ago, there was a disaster, the Wahine disaster, where a ferry hit the reef coming into the harbor on a really bad stormy day, and many lives were lost. And this is a pivotal thing, but also that point in the harbor is also significant in Maori history. And there happens to be a small cave at the entrance to the harbor on the Wellington side, and that cave, many Wellingtonians know about it, and there was a man who lived there for numerous years, he extended the cave by hand. I'm looking at this thing as a cuckoo clock that comes in and out of the cave to greet or to caution ferries, freight liners, boaties, airplanes. The airplane path to the airport is right there as well. So the sound part of it is not just the recording of the performance, but we are making a original work that imagines the rock, not the rock of the mountain or the cave breathing, but what does it sound? I don't want to personify it. What does it sound? If you go online, there's lots of examples of, say, when seismologists record earthquakes, that the sound is not just the sound we hear when the land shifts in a big way, but the rocks are moving and sounding for many, many months, sometimes years afterwards. So I maintain that we can still feel the vibrations, the auditory vibrations. Well, we can't hear them necessarily, but we can feel them from the Christchurch or the Kaikoura earthquake here. Yeah, so this sound work that we're putting into the film is looking at a whole bunch of different ways that rocks have been recorded as sounding. And then we are using what's called in Māori, Moteatea, and that it's a kind of poetry, a waiata, or a song. And we're not looking to borrow one of those because neither one of us is Indigenous, but I'm listening to a whole bunch of them, looking for what they might share in terms of their beat. And this is going to be the underlying thing of the sound work. Watch this space.
Sorry, you just cut out right as you said that. Can you repeat that last?
Oh, just watch this space.
Oh.
Probably will come out. I'll be looking for a place to show it. Any listeners to this that want to send me a place? I don't know how to exhibit any longer with this COVID thing.
Yes, but, it does.
looking for a place to show it in the next year.
Wow. Well, that sounds fascinating. I would love to see it. So I guess it'll be on your webpage. Will there be updates?
Well, as soon as I get, I usually don't put things on my webpage until they're actually like put out for the public.
Yeah, right.
And I'm hopeful. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, that sounds really interesting. So I look forward to seeing it.
Thank you, Sadie.
I realize I've taken up a lot of your time, and I just
you're indulging me. That's so important.
No, I just so appreciate hearing about your work, and it's really interesting. I've really enjoyed looking at it and learning about it. Well, I look forward to seeing your presentation in person in a year. But I just had one last question, really. And but then I would invite you to, if there's anything that you would like to include in this interview, I would welcome you to include it. But I was just wondering what you're listening to right now these days, if anything, or maybe silence. It's kind of been an interesting question when people are spending so much time at home.
I knew that you were going to ask that question. And I wish I had a long repertoire, send you my Spotify list, but I don't think that's quite accurate. What am I listening to right now? Well, I am listening to a lot of Wayata or Motete, which is in spoken poetry form or sung form. And that's to help me increase my Tareo Māori language skills, as well as to feel the beat. I tend to learn things better when they're performed. So the hearing language and hearing it with music is helping me. That's definitely one of the things. I'm a big fan of PJ Harvey. If anybody, hope nobody judges me too poorly for that. And it just so happens over the last 3 years, I have gotten into taking lessons online, of all things, for kooning, which is, I don't know if you are aware of it. It's a Scandinavian, Swedish, perhaps Pacific. I went searching for my roots and I veered towards three places, Wales, Sweden and Croatia. That's my bloodline. And in Sweden, the kooning is a practice of young and elderly women calling their herds, calling their cows, calling their sheep, calling their horses. And there's historically a practice where they go out into the forests, into the landscape with their herds to graze them, and they will call them back around a body of water, but they will camp around the body of water in different places. So they may be by themselves as individuals with their herd, and they will call them with these calls. Like, you know, a little bit like the last work I described, which has a siren, Ulysses siren quality to it. This is it's slightly melodic, and I'm not going to do it because I'm not authorized to yet. But it's a way of calling that has a lyrical quality to it. It goes, la da da, la da da. And you learn it. It's a different way of singing or sounding with your body, but you pull up from your pelvis and the sound comes out of your body as if it's a force of air. And the force is regulated, but you push it through the forest. So practicing in the forest, I'm just looking out beyond my trees here and there's a forest where I practice. And it resonates amongst the trees. So you learn to throw your voice or the sound out so the animals can hear. And of course the animals learn your sound and they learn that that's time to come home and have some dinner. And often the shepherdess would call to one another across the lake. You can imagine the acoustic value of the Scandinavian lakes, which are smooth and the surface quite taut, what that might sound like. So that's what I'm listening to right now to be able to better myself in that way.
That's way better than a playlist. You're listening to learn language and it's your heritage, and that's a dynamic answer. It'd be great to include if you had a sample of any of this. I'm just very intrigued. We could include it.
Well, there are people who do it far better than I do. If you just look up K-U-umlaut, L-N, Kooning, there will come up many people who are excellent teachers at it and have all the long flowing hair to compliment. Yeah, I'm hoping to do a performance there. And this is one of the things about COVID-19 and also the insistence on live performance. The recordings can't do it. And so I think I might be starting to go away from recording period and just do live performances. They might be invited, small groups. So if you want to come to a lake in Sweden in maybe 2022.
I would love to. That sounds,
let me know.
I'll be there. Well, thank you so much. It was great to hear about all of your work and what you're listening to and your projects. And it's just such a kind of dynamic practice that you have. So I'm really glad that you wanted to have a conversation in person about it. because
I'm so flattered that you asked and that you all are doing this. This is, and I can't wait to hear all the others that you're interviewing or ask. It's a very nice effort you're doing. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And I'll send you, or I'll be in touch with what I'm working with. And any thoughts you have about how you would like this to be presented, or if you thought of any links to your work or music you wanted to include, then let me know. Yeah, thank you so much. And it was really great to meet you.
Good to meet you too.
Bye, Juliana.